protesters rocked universities across the United States this week. And with the U.S. presidential election mere months away, the timing for President Joe Biden couldn't be much worse.
There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
This is Swamp Notes, the weekly podcast from the FT News Briefing, where we talk about just all of the things happening in the 2024 U.S. presidential election. I'm Mark Filipino. This week, we're asking, how could nationwide student protests over the Israel-Hamas war impact Biden's re-election odds? Here with me to discuss is James Politi. He's the FT's Washington bureau chief. Hey, James.
Hey, good to be here, Mark.
And we've also got Joshua Chaffin on the line. He's the FT's New York correspondent. Hi, Josh.
How are you, Mark?
I'm doing well. So, Josh, get us up to speed. You've been going up to report on the protests at Columbia University. How did these and the wider protest movement start? And how did we get to this moment where riot police are storming university buildings?
I guess like everything in this conflict, it sort of depends how far back you wind the clock. But the proximate date was about 2 weeks ago when Columbia's president, Manoush Shafiq, testified before a House committee that was investigating anti-Semitism on campus.
And we would do whatever is necessary to ensure the safety of our campus. Because of those efforts, the vast majority of our demonstrations have been peaceful. Second, we would demonstrate...
Her testimony, I think it passed muster with her Republican inquisitors, but I think it may have given oxygen to the protests. And then she made the fateful decision to send in the police, and that seems to have really backfired. The encampment really swelled from there. You began to see copycats spring up across the country. And then fast forward to just a couple days ago, earlier this week, a group of Columbia protesters took over a building on campus, and that prompted the administration to finally call in the police again.
One, police officers seen filing in on an extended ramp into the second floor of Columbia's Hamilton Hall.
James, can you tell us how these protests and all this domestic pressure is impacting Biden right now? How is he going about his response?
Well, it's been a problem for the Biden campaign. You know, Gaza has been a problem for the Biden campaign ever since the Israeli response to the Hamas attacks began in October, and civilian casualties have mounted because it has created a lot of anger and frustration among some core constituencies of Biden's coalition. We talk a lot about Arab American voters, but it's broader than that. These protests have kind of fractured his base. On the other hand, we also know that if he takes a position that is too strongly associated with the protests, he risks alienate some of the more moderate Democrats, people in the middle. So it's a very difficult balancing act. And just this week, he came out, was forced to make a statement on the protest and tried to strike that balancing act by saying, look, America is not an authoritarian regime. People have the right to peacefully protest. We have a First Amendment freedom of speech. On the other hand, we're not a lawless country either. He's also been exposed to Republican attacks that he's been weak and feckless in denouncing the protesters. Donald Trump has come out and praised the law enforcement. It's a foreign policy challenge compounded with a domestic policy challenge at the moment for Biden, and it's really hard for him.
Okay, so you mentioned his base here, which gets us to the big questions about these protests and the election. And to get some insight into those questions, I spoke earlier this week to two students, Dalia Saba from the University of Wisconsin and Noah Fay from Columbia University. They both have very different perspectives on what these protests mean. And Dalia, she's of Palestinian descent. She's been involved in protests on campus, and she made it clear that she would not vote for Biden this November.
So I was involved a few months ago in the Listen to Wisconsin campaign. So that was a campaign where we wanted to send a message to President Biden, and we got, you know, tens of thousands of people in the state of Wisconsin to vote uninstructed to communicate that we are deeply unhappy with Joe Biden's policies in Israel. I think that the Democratic Party has, for a long time now, coerced its constituents into voting for them by saying that the other guy is worse. Trump is worse. The Republicans are worse. And so therefore, you have to suck it up and vote for us. It's really about sending a message to the two-party system that we have now that these two parties are broken.
James, as you heard there, Dahlia really wants to send a message to the Democratic Party that her vote can't be taken for granted. And her vote is important because she is registered to vote in the state of Wisconsin. What could that mean for the party going forward?
Well, Wisconsin is one of the three key states that make up what's known as the blue wall of American politics, which is Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. All three have held primaries already this year. And as she said, tens of thousands of voters in Wisconsin chose alternatives to Biden. And I think that if all of them end up not voting for Biden, he's in real trouble in November. He's in a situation where he's going to have to try to win the MAC, and there's no guarantee that he will.
Yeah. I also, as I mentioned, spoke to a Jewish student at Columbia named Noah Fay. We asked her whether she was concerned that her fellow young Democrats would abstain from voting this year.
I don't know if they're actually serious about not voting for Biden. You know, in the 2020 election, people were also having the same issue. They didn't want to vote for Biden, but we all rallied together and clarified for everybody that if you're not voting for Biden, you are effectively voting for Trump.
James, what do you make of that? Do you expect those young Democrats who are upset by Biden's Israel policy to ultimately revert to his camp come Election Day because they're so upset with Donald Trump?
I think the one thing that could really make a difference is if Biden is able to strike a deal or broker a deal for a ceasefire combined with the release of the hostages who are still held in Gaza. That would be a big diplomatic success, and it's something that he could point to in the final stretch of the campaign. But I think there's another bet that the Biden campaign is making, which is that ultimately Gaza will not be the deciding issue in the campaign for many of these voters, that while there is a kind of hardcore of the Democratic base that is very energized, upset about this, that ultimately most young voters, most people of color will vote on other issues, including abortion, the economy, the character and temperament of Donald Trump, and that Gaza will not be the defining issue of the campaign.
That's quite the bet. Josh, you spent some time at Columbia, as I mentioned, and I'm curious about how you're thinking about this in the context of major protest movements that have taken place during previous election years. I'm thinking about the 1968 Democratic National Convention, where the Chicago Police Department basically went to battle with anti-Vietnam War protesters. Then you've got the George Floyd protests in the summer before the 2020 election. How have these shaped presidential races?
It's funny. It's hard to go to Columbia or to have been there and not to think kind of constantly about 1968. And it's even more eerie because the Democratic convention is again in Chicago this year, as it was in 1968. But the disorder, I think, of 1968 has been sort of blamed for kind of a souring national mood or a manifestation of it. And as you know, the Democrats were the incumbents and they lost that year. And we had Richard Nixon in 2020. Again, I think those protests also contributed to a kind of very sour national mood. And again, the incumbent, this time the Republicans, lost. I think one way that the protests are quite different, they kind of draw on history, but obviously they have the energy of social media behind them, which, you know, it makes it easier to impassion people and for students to organize. And I think another feature is that we really saw beginning with the Black Lives Matter protest is this fusion of many different groups on the left marching together, so that you have groups like Queers for Palestine, who you might not have, you know, previously associated with the Palestinian cause, but you have a whole bunch of those who have now come together.
You've also, I mean, the school is going to end soon. So it's a real big question whether or not this momentum is going to carry over into the summer and then eventually the fall when school starts back up again and we head into the election.
I asked this very question actually to a protester a few days ago at Columbia. Her answer was, our passion and the urgency of this is not dictated by the beginning and the end of the school semester. And I think with social media and smartphones and the rest of it, it's going to be pretty easy for these people. You know, they've all formed, I think, very intense bonds in this period, and they're now going to kind of carry those to different places and presumably link up in new ways. But I think it'll be fascinating to see how that morphs over the summer.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to do exit poll.
In a new series of Tectonic from the Financial Times, we go to the front lines of China's rise as a tech superpower. From the factories of Shenzhen, China's Silicon Valley, to Nigeria, where Chinese phones dominate.
Oppo, Vivo.
And Germany, where Chinese electric vehicles may overtake the big car makers. Subscribe to Tectonic wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back with Exit Poll, where we talk about something that did not happen on the campaign trail and apply rigorous political analysis to it. In a bit of fuzzier foreign policy adjacent news, China confirmed this week that it would send two giant pandas to the San Diego Zoo as part of the country's famous panda diplomacy. I am very excited about this because I love pandas. Josh, James, at a time of fraught U.S.-China relations, could this gift be anything other than great news for Biden, or am I missing something here?
I don't think much of it. First of all, I think the panda is sort of yesterday's zoo animal.
Wow. Wow, Josh, this will be your last time on this show.
And I think, the Chinese send us a few pandas. They take them back. You know, we play nice. They talk about sending over another panda. You know, I'm done with the panda games. I want a koala bear or a meerkat, a Tasmanian, something or other.
You think you know a guy, really. I'm still getting over the fact that the DC pandas are gone. That was right in my backyard. James, what do you think?
A lot of tears were shed when the DC pandas
It was a bad day.
It was a bad day. But this gets to Biden's probably biggest diplomatic accomplishment of the last year or so has been to cool down tensions with the Chinese. He's got conflict in Europe, conflict in the Middle East. The last thing he needed was conflict in the Indo-Pacific. And it looks like the Chinese have embraced that. And here we go. We've got the pandas back.
James, would it make sense to take a panda on the campaign trail?
We should think about that. I don't know how they survive in Wisconsin, but
no. Biden can say, look right here, look what I've done. Look what I've delivered you.
All right, I want to thank our guest, James Politi, who is the FT's Washington Bureau Chief. Thanks so much, James.
Thanks, Mark.
And Joshua Chaffin, he's our New York correspondent who apparently hates pandas. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Not that you asked, but there are exactly 185 days until Election Day. And the best way to stay on top of all of the U.S. political news is with our new twice-weekly U.S. Election Countdown newsletter written by our Washington reporter, Steph Chavez. Click the link in the show notes to sign up. This was Swamp Notes, the U.S. politics show from the FT News Briefing. If you want to sign up for the Swamp Notes newsletter, we've got a link to that in the show notes, too. Our show is mixed and produced by Ethan Plotkin. It's also produced by Lauren Fedor, Sonia Hudson, and this week, Kasia Broussalian. Special thanks to Pierre Nicholson. Original music by Hannes Brown. I'm your host, Mark Filippino. Our executive producer is Topher Forges, and Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. Check back next week for more U.S. political analysis from the Financial Times.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.